Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. President Trump has about a month and a half left in the White House, and it's typical for lame duck presidents to use that time to issue pardons and commute the sentences of people who've been convicted of federal crimes. As some may remember, President Obama commuted the sentences of nearly 2,000 drug offenders during his final week in office. According to reporting from various major outlets, President Trump is considering taking a rather different approach, possibly issuing blanket preemptive pardons for allies and family members. He's even claimed that he has the right to pardon himself. Like many things during the Trump presidency, those pardons would be largely unprecedented and controversial. But presidents do have a lot of leeway when it comes to the power to grant clemency. So to better understand that power, how the president has used it and may plan to use it, here with me today is Amelia Thompson DeVoe. Amelia is, of course, a senior writer here at 538 and our legal correspondent. Welcome, Amelia.
Thanks, Galen. Nice to be here.
So bring me back to Civics 101. Why do presidents have the ability to just override the judicial system and grant pardons or commute sentences?
Yeah, so this power is incredibly broad. And to understand why the founding fathers made it part of the president's power, you have to sort of go back to that time when they were concerned about overreach by the legislative branch, by the judicial branch, and they were trying to set up the system that basically allowed those branches to have different checks on each other. You may remember from Schoolhouse Rock. And
can you do the song while we're here?
Oh man, I wish. I really wish I could do the song. Can you do the song?
No, I can't. But listeners, imagine, here's the part where we sing a song in unison from Schoolhouse Rock. Anyway, go ahead.
So the idea is basically that the legislative branch is inevitably going to pass laws that are too harsh or sort of get things wrong in various ways. The judicial system is made up of fallible human beings who are going to issue sentences that are unfair, or prosecutors who are going to push for sentences that are too long. And you want the president to have the power to basically bestow mercy on people. You want to have a check on those two parts of the government. And this was a power that the king had, which might sound a little bit surprising because the founding fathers were not super into the idea of kings in general, at least not all of them. But the idea that there would be this power to grant clemency and that it would be basically unlimited was quite familiar to them. And the idea was just basically that there needs to be some kind of check. And that's how pardons and commutations and other forms of clemency that were more common in the past but aren't really used now were intended.
Does a pardon eliminate all criminal liability?
So it really depends on what the pardon is. And the first thing to say about pardons is that they don't erase convictions. So, like, it's not to say that you didn't commit a crime if you were convicted of a crime because you were pardoned for it. Usually the way they work is that someone will be convicted of a federal crime. And obviously when we're talking about pardons, the president can only pardon for federal crimes and commute federal sentences. And that's pretty important for, you know, sort of understanding the limits of this power. It's extremely broad, but you can't pardon for state law offenses. So the way it usually works is that someone will have served their time and they will present some kind of application to the president. And how this has happened in the past has varied, but there's a pretty streamlined process for it now through what's known as the Office of the Pardon Attorney. And they'll say, hey, look, I deserve to be given the rights and privileges of a person who has not committed a federal crime back, like, you know, in some cases owning a gun, in some cases being able to vote. I deserve to get those back because I've repaid my debt to society and I have changed in these various ways. Please give me a pardon. So it's not like this was designed to obliterate guilt. In some ways, accepting a pardon can be seen as an admission of guilt, in fact. And you're just sort of, it's sort of allowing you to move forward with the rights that people who weren't convicted of federal crimes have. Obviously, that's not how pardons have always been used, but that's the idea behind them.
Okay, so now that we understand the concept, how has this played out in practice historically? What do presidents most often use this pardon power or clemency power more broadly for? And what are maybe the examples where it wasn't used according to the intentions?
In the earlier days of the country, this power was used pretty much ad hoc. There wasn't really a process for it. I was writing a different story about pardons that I was just looking at this morning. It came out a couple of years ago, but I was reminded that there was this case where Jefferson was presented with applications for pardons of goose thieves. And it was like two different goose thieves in the same week or something like that. And he was like, didn't I just pardon this person? Like, didn't I just pardon a goose thief? And so like, that was like the level of process that existed at that moment. Starting around the turn of the 20th century, a more streamlined process for receiving applications from people and reviewing them was established. But that still meant that presidents could kind of do whatever they wanted. And there were controversial pardons going back to Lincoln, famously pardoned Union deserters, which was not a move that was popular in all quarters, but he felt that it was necessary to preserve national harmony. And I should say that's another use that the pardon power has sort of been seen to fill historically. This idea that there are some moments when, after a war or some kind of national trauma, when prosecuting people or letting people go to prison, not forgiving them for crimes, may actually prolong and widen rifts.
I assume that you're referring to Jimmy Carter pardoning the thousands of Americans who illegally avoided the draft.
Exactly. And George Washington pardoning the people who were involved in the Whiskey Rebellion. So it's not just about saying, hey, this person's sentence was too long, they were in prison for too many years, or they've just become a better person and they deserve to have their rights back. It's also sometimes about these bigger gestures that make sure that the country, like sort of unity is preserved, which like sounds a little bit cheesy, but I think it is a justification the presidents really do think about and have thought about historically. And it has been controversial in the past, but I should say that also there have been pardons that have just been controversial and not for terribly high-minded justifications. And there are some of those that have been more recent. So people who can think back to when Bill Clinton was leaving office might remember that he pardoned a whole bunch of people on the way out the door. And among those were his brother, who had already served his time in prison. But, you know, the fact that he got a pardon was controversial at the time, and also Mark Rich, who was a fugitive financier who was actually living in Switzerland to evade prosecution, and his ex-wife was a longtime donor to the Clintons. So that was another pardon that kind of raised some eyebrows. And another example is when George H.W. Bush was leaving office, he pardoned Caspar Weinberger and a number of other people from the Reagan administration who were implicated in the Iran-Contra scandal and were actually slated to go on trial within a few months. And Bush himself was likely going to be called as a witness in that trial. And it was sort of unclear if Bush was implicated. You know, I think we never found out because they were pardoned. The trial never happened. And the prosecutor in that case was really, really mad about it and actually accused Bush of perpetuating a cover-up through the pardons. So I think it's fair to say that like this power has been used controversially in the past. And sometimes when it's controversial, presidents have these high-minded justifications. And sometimes those are a little harder to find.
Perhaps the most famous presidential pardon is Ford pardoning Nixon for any crimes he may have committed while in office. It was a blanket pardon. It didn't apply to any specific charges that had already been made. And of course, there were no convictions. Where does that fall into either the category of high-minded pardons or pardons of convenience that don't have such lofty aims? Or maybe both.
Yeah, it kind of is both, because Ford pardoned Nixon really soon after Nixon resigned. And the way he justified it afterward was to say, hey, look, it would not be good for the country after this long Watergate scandal that ended with Nixon resigning the presidency for us to prosecute the president and for the country to have to live through a criminal trial of a former president. That's not something that would be good and that would serve national aims. And so pardoning Nixon was something he justified as basically letting the country move on, that this had already been traumatic enough. It was clear enough that Nixon had participated in wrongdoing, criminal wrongdoing even, to the point where he couldn't be president anymore. Let's just leave it at that and move on.
Did Americans agree with that rationale?
Yeah, they kind of didn't. So I think, you know, Ford thought, or at least said, he was trying to do a good thing here. It's hard to tell exactly what the political consequences of any particular action were, but his approval ratings dropped, and he was only president for a short time after that, just a couple of years, and then lost his next election. And the pardon has been sort of seen as, you know, maybe the beginning of the end in terms of Ford being able to serve another term as president. And I think that actually, in some ways, has served as a cautionary tale for presidents who came after, that Americans are not always receptive to these higher-minded justifications about why mercy is necessary, and that pardons can be a pretty serious political liability.
All right, so we've established some of the foundations of pardons. Let's talk about Trump. We know that there's reporting about him considering using pardons for his family, his allies, his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. He has already used pardons in some high-profile ways for Michael Flynn, his former national security advisor, Roger Stone. You've dug through the data, actually, of both recent presidents and Trump himself. Looking at the opus of his clemency, how does it compare to past presidents, and what kinds of things in particular has he focused on?
I was honestly a little bit shocked when I looked at this data, because I knew that Trump hadn't pardoned all that many people or commuted the sentences of all that many people. But the extent to which he is not in line with other presidents is pretty dramatic. I mean, this could change. One of the things that I also looked into was the share of acts of clemency that tend to come toward the end of a president's term. And it's really, really high in the modern era. So it is possible that Trump could go on a big pardoning spree and his record would look less stingy. But right now, Trump has pardoned less than 30 people. He has commuted the sentences of less than 20 people. And that's compared to Barack Obama, who had pardoned over 200 people by the time he left office and commuted the sentences of almost 2,000 people. And even George W. Bush, who pardoned 189 people and commuted the sentences of 11 people. So that's a lot less than Obama. And I think the trend in recent years, probably because of that political liability issue that I was mentioning, is that presidents just don't use this power all that much. But Trump's numbers are really, really low. And it's not just that they're low. The people that he has given pardons to are also pretty different. And I looked at an analysis done by some folks for Lawfare, which dug in pretty serious detail into sort of the, like, did these pardons follow the normal process for by which pardons are granted? And did these people have political connections to Trump? And was there a political benefit to Trump by pardoning people? And what they found is that there were some cases where it didn't seem like Trump had a connection to the people who were pardoned, and there wasn't an incredibly obvious political benefit, but those were really the exception. Trump has given pardons to people who were allies of his, like former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was one of the first people he pardoned toward the beginning of his presidency, and that was a very controversial pardon. And he's also given pardons to people whose cases have kind of been made in unorthodox ways, specifically on Fox News. So Rod Blagojevich, who was the former governor of Illinois and was until recently serving a federal sentence, his wife went on Fox News and was making this impassioned case for why he should be given clemency. And then, lo and behold, he's given clemency. And so there's like a pattern of two things happening with Trump's pardons. It's that there aren't very many of them, and they're not going to ordinary people who are making this case about, like, look, I've repaid my debt to society and I have reformed my ways, or, you know, however these cases are made. It's really situations that by and large seem to benefit Trump in some way by using this power.
I think people may remember from both the Republican National Convention and perhaps following the news, either political or celebrity news, that Kim Kardashian lobbied the president to commute the sentence of Alice Johnson, who was a first-time nonviolent drug offender, and he commuted her sentence and then gave her a full pardon. Are you saying that that is basically the minority of cases? That has not largely how the president has used his clemency power?
It's the minority of cases, and honestly, I think I'd make the argument that that kind of falls into the self-serving category in a way, because she was in a Super Bowl ad for the president. So even though Trump has commuted the sentences or issued pardons for people who are seen as the more traditional recipients of clemency, Trump has then also used those for political ends, in this case to say, like, look how good I am on criminal justice reform. When you look at, you know, the number of people in that category, like drug offenders, who he has pardoned or commuted the sentences of, there really aren't that many. To give Trump credit, there have been some, but it's nowhere near as many as Obama, for example. And again, he's got a month and a half left. Maybe he'll hear this podcast and decide that he's going to pardon a bunch of drug offenders, but that's not what he's done so far.
It's worth saying that those 1,700 drug offenders who were pardoned under Obama, or their sentences were commuted under Obama, that was his final week in office. So
yes,
we discussed all of the potential political liability, why this happens during a lame duck presidency, and so on. So very well, things could change. I do want to focus, though, on perhaps the most controversial way that things could change in terms of the president's record on pardoning people. His kids, his lawyer, things like that. What kind of precedent is there for issuing blanket preemptive pardons for people who have not been charged with a crime or convicted of a crime, in particular who may be friends or allies?
So that specific nexus of things, there is really no precedent for. Like, as I mentioned earlier, presidents have pardoned friends and allies in the past. Bill Clinton pardoned his brother. His brother had already served his term in federal prison. So that's different in the sense that maybe you say that a president's family member shouldn't get unfair access to this kind of clemency, but it wasn't like he was being pardoned preemptively. And then preemptive pardons are also a thing that have happened before. Famously, the pardon of Richard Nixon, which was extremely broad, and Nixon had not been charged with a crime at that point. And the wording of the pardon didn't just forgive Nixon for crimes that were related to the Watergate scandal. The way it was worded just left it open to any crimes against the U.S. that might have been committed during Nixon's time in office. So it was super, super broad. And that's happened before. But I guess you could say that Nixon was kind of Ford's ally, but like not in the same way that we're talking about with Rudy Giuliani or Trump's kids.
Is this definitely legal? Have any of these instances been challenged in court? The breadth of the Nixon pardon or the preemptiveness of it?
So the pardon power, the Supreme Court has basically held this power is pretty much unlimited. And I'll say the big exception to that is a self-pardon. So we don't know if a self-pardon is constitutional. And so it's one of the—
We could find out.
Lovely unanswered questions that, yes, could end up being answered for us. But for the most part, this is a power that really relies on the president to adhere to norms and to fear political backlash. And those are the kind of things that keep the power from being used in ways that it wasn't intended for. It's very hard to challenge one of these pardons. I even asked some of the legal experts that I talked to for my most recent story on pardons, what would happen if there was someone paid a bribe for a pardon? And what they told me was, this is a little bit unclear, but probably the pardon would stand, even though the bribe itself could subsequently be subject to prosecution. But then it gets messy because depending on the timing of all of this, you know, then there could be a pardon for the crimes that led to the bribe. So there are like a lot of ways for this power to be used that are pretty unsavory. And mostly we just like haven't gotten into that territory because presidents have felt like, for whatever reason, it is not right to use the power that way, or there's going to be a big political backlash. But Trump has really not cared about the political backlash in the same way as past presidents, pretty much since the beginning of his presidency. So I think it's fair to say, you know, it's hard to predict what he's going to do, but it's easier to imagine him moving into this unprecedented territory, certainly, than past presidents.
Yeah, another example of where norms have defined behavior as opposed to law, and norms don't necessarily restrict people in any absolute way. I want to talk about some of the specific legal liability that Trump would be trying to pardon on behalf of his inner circle. But first,
hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've mentioned reporting that Trump is considering pardoning all kinds of people in his circle. Some reports say the list is currently at about 20 people, but he is considering whether or not he wants to just give out all of these blanket preemptive pardons because it may seem to imply that some people are guilty. And in lots of these cases, or all of these cases, no one has been charged or convicted. And so if there's no reason to grant a pardon, you wouldn't want to. But he may also suspect that there is a reason that he wants to grant pardons to some of the people in his family or close to him. So Amelia, can you spell that out for us? What legal liability is he worried about for Donald Jr., Eric, Ivanka, Rudy Giuliani, and other people close to him, Jared Kushner, et cetera?
You know, it's a little bit hard to say exactly what he's imagining for exactly the reasons that you spelled out, because this isn't a situation where there are like federal charges that clearly he's responding to. But, you know, I think you could imagine a whole variety of potential scenarios. There are criminal charges against associates of Rudy Giuliani, for example. And so there have been questions for a while about whether Giuliani was going to be implicated in that prosecution. There's the fact that there actually is an open criminal case that people can think way back to the days of the Mueller investigation, which now feel very long ago. But folks may remember that it appears to be Donald Trump was named in the charges against his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, in a case involving alleged illegal campaign contributions.
And that's Stormy Daniels, right?
That's Stormy Daniels, yeah.
And to clarify for listeners, it's a hush money payment based on an affair that he would have allegedly had with Stormy Daniels, an adult film actress.
Right. And Michael Cohen ended up going to federal prison for that. Trump is in the situation of basically having been shielded from legal liability through his whole presidency, which is a little bit of an open question whether that is actually the case. But in practice, it's been the case because everyone has agreed to this interpretation that a president can't be charged with crimes while he's in office. Of course, that liability or that protection is gone as soon as he leaves the White House. And I think that one of the big things that's sort of a question mark are these questions about potential tax fraud. And this is something that the New York Times has done really extensive reporting into, the way that Trump has paid his taxes over many decades. It's obviously hard to know what in there a prosecutor would choose to charge and how that would go. But there certainly seems to be some behavior that has been documented in the media that I think is fair to say is legally questionable. For example, you know, like huge write-offs for things like haircuts. And then there are all these questions also about the funding of Trump's inaugural committee. There are just sort of all of these little threads that where there are investigations, they haven't touched Trump so far directly, and it's just not clear whether that's because he's president and the people who are following those threads feel that they can't legally go after the president while he is president, or if for some reason there isn't a case there. And I think that's one of the things that's kind of tricky about this for Trump, as you were saying, because he doesn't know what's going to happen after he leaves office. And the big part of this depends on Biden's willingness, or Biden's attorney general's willingness, to go after him. And going back to some of those like high-minded justifications we've heard for why pardons have been granted, Biden's been talking a lot about unity and how it's really not a thing we do in this country for a new president to prosecute the outgoing president. So it's sort of this weird situation where, like, what Trump might end up doing, because the pardon is just for federal crimes, is if he pardons himself, or he pardons his kids, or he pardons Giuliani, that none of those might have actually led to a prosecution anyway, because Biden doesn't really want to do that. But state prosecutors might be like, ooh, okay, so he issued pardons to all those people, so that must mean that there's some smoke there, and we're going to go see if there's fire. And he can't pardon, like, he can't stop the Attorney General of New York from looking into his taxes. The Attorney General of New York already is. And so there's sort of this, like, weird tension of, does issuing this pardon actually in some ways potentially motivate state actors to say, oh, there actually may have been some wrongdoing here, and let's see if it would violate state law and go after him or his family members.
All right. So that gives us a little bit of a picture of what is going through the president's mind and what kind of liability might be facing the people close to him. When it comes to these kinds of pardons for family, allies, or oneself, how do constitutional scholars think of this? We've clarified that it seems largely legal, but question mark next to pardoning oneself, it would require a constitutional amendment. So this is very theoretical. But do people think that the pardon power is too broad, that it's used too much, that it maybe even is used too little? How do the scholars that you've talked to think about these questions?
Yeah, so I mean, mostly they think it's not used enough, which is interesting because I think you could very easily look at, like, for example, Trump's track record on this and say, ooh, maybe there should be some more restrictions on how presidents can use this. But the folks that I've talked to have said, no, there is a really important place for this power. Most federal prisoners can't get parole. So if you are in federal prison and you're serving a life sentence, a presidential pardon or a commutation, like, that's your shot, you know, and especially like at a moment when a lot of people are looking back at the laws that were passed in the 80s and 90s around the war on drugs and saying, like, those were probably way too long and we have way too many people in prison. You know, I've talked to quite a few people who have said, no, actually, like, presidents should be using this power more and they should be using it more regularly and they should really see it as part of their job to look for places where either the way laws have written have failed Americans in some sense, or the way that they were applied by judges or prosecutors has failed, and that more of those people should be getting clemency. That doesn't mean that those people want there to be more pardons like Rod Blagojevich or Mark Rich or even necessarily like Richard Nixon. I think the high-profile pardons that people think about are not the ones, by and large, that the folks that I've been talking to think there should be more of. The problem is just that those are the only ones that people hear about anymore because presidents don't use the power that much. And when they do use it, it's sometimes in these very controversial ways.
Are they worried about those controversial ways? The ones where, like, Bill Clinton pardoning somebody who's helped his campaigns, or Bush Sr. pardoning folks that were involved in the Iran-Contra scandal?
Yeah, there are real worries about that, and there are even more worries about Trump, precisely because the more of these controversial pardons there are, the more just Americans get the sense that this is a mechanism that presidents use to help their friends or to get themselves out of legal hot water, and they don't think about clemency in the terms that most experts on this see the founders thinking about it, which is acts of mercy that should basically go to ordinary people. So the worry is, I mean, in a kind of extreme situation, you could imagine a constitutional amendment that would explicitly limit the pardon power. I don't know about you. I think it's pretty difficult for me to imagine a constitutional amendment on anything getting through our political system right now. So that seems pretty unlikely, even if people are pretty mad about the pardon power. But the other thing is just that we know already the presidents see pardons and commutations as a potential source of political liability. And so I think the more realistic worry is just that the more people get the sense that this is just kind of an avenue for corruption, the more they will punish presidents for using it politically. And that has created a situation where presidents already use it much less than they did in the past. And you could see that continuing in the future. It'll be really interesting to see how Biden uses the power, for example, whether he tries to follow in Obama's footsteps and commute the sentences of a lot of drug offenders, whether he waits until the end of his presidency, whenever that is. I think that'll tell us something about how he's reading the tea leaves politically, about what Trump's pardons have done to perceptions of this power.
Right. It's an important question because it seems like Trump has done a lot of things that might traditionally tick off voters, but that he has a high floor. And one, he may not be worried about the political repercussions at this point if he doesn't plan on running again. But if he does plan on running in 2024, maybe he does care. So we will see what the president does, and we will see if there are any political repercussions. Thank you so much for that very detailed education on pardons. I have learned a lot. But I do have one more question for you before you leave the podcast. While we have your legal reporting skills here and the Electoral College is meeting on Monday, I want to get a little bit of an update on the kinds of legal maneuvering that the president and his lawyers have been using to try to overturn the election and what has happened. Maybe this is somewhat brief because I've been reading the news and it doesn't look like they've been making much headway or actually any headway at all. But what arguments have they been making? And are there any arguments left to make? And is this done in the courts?
This is a fun one because I keep thinking they will run out of arguments to make. And yet this is still playing out in court, even though from the beginning, it's been quite clear that the results of the election were not going to be overturned by Trump's legal maneuvering for a variety of reasons. The results were just not close. And so his lawyers in the states have been making a variety of arguments that have been getting uniformly rejected, or almost uniformly rejected. And they either are about issues that really have no chance of affecting the outcome of the election, that affect just a very, very, very small number of votes. And those are the places where they have gotten a few very small limited victories, but they're meaningless because it's nowhere near the magnitude that would be needed to change the results in, for example, a state like Pennsylvania. And it would have to happen in multiple states for Trump to even have a chance of overturning the result. And then there have just been arguments that have been much broader, basically challenging like the whole setup of vote by mail, which is just to go into court and say the vote by mail in a state, the way it was set up, is unconstitutional after an election has already happened, is not going to happen. And federal judges had basically been saying, in more or less polite terms, get out of my courtroom, and some state judges too. So we're now at a point where all of the states have certified their results, and there is now a request for an emergency order from Republican-led states, led by Texas, but this is supported by Trump, asking to invalidate millions of ballots in Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And I think this has proved that you can bring all kinds of arguments in court and that it doesn't have any bearing on whether they're going to be successful. So if this was successful, it could swing the election to Trump. It is vanishingly unlikely that the Supreme Court would choose to do this.
A lot of times when we talk about the court system, we are talking about the persuasions of the judges and justices involved, whether they are liberal or conservative leaning, who appointed them. does it seem like there is any ideological divide on the bench when it comes to these elections issues?
I mean, not really. I think we've seen a lot of judges appointed by Republicans, appointed by Democrats from different states that explicitly elect judges on party lines, and they're all coming down the same way. And I think even though the Supreme Court now has this very strong six-justice conservative majority, they also really seem to have no appetite to wade into this. So it's been a pretty strong statement of the independence of the judiciary. It also would be pretty shocking if it had come out any other way, just because the results of the election were so decisive. So both in terms of the size of Biden's Electoral College victory and the margins that he won by in key states. It's just much harder to say, and like I probably shouldn't even speculate, what would have happened if we'd had a situation with a narrower margin in a single pivotal state that the election could have turned on, and there were a bunch of legal challenges there. Like, we might have had the same outcome. I mean, to that, yes, exactly. Like, if we had a repeat of the 2000 election, it's harder to predict what would have happened. But in this case, what you're hearing from judges just over and over again is like, you are asking me to overturn the clear result of an election, and I'm just not going to do that. And so it's really encouraging to see judge after judge reinforce that principle. It also would have been pretty, frankly, disturbing, I think, if we had seen any other movement in the other direction, just given how weak these legal arguments were.
All right. Well, enlightening as always, but let's leave it there for now. Thanks, Amelia.
Thanks, Galen.
Amelia Thompson-DeVoe is a senior writer at 538 and our legal correspondent for this podcast. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. Claire Bittigieri-Curtis is on audio editing. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.